Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
So let me first reach out and give everybody a ginormous air hug. And just checking in from the front lines here, something really interesting went on this week. Well, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, nurses wore white. Then the 90s came along. Along with the 90s came colorful scrubs on the nurses. Little kittens, hearts, candy canes for Christmas. It got very interesting and kind of fun. And I actually think it spawned an entire industry of really cool novelty fabrics, or certainly supported its growth. And this supported the revival of quilting as an art form. It was, well, I shouldn't say the revival, it had never really died, but certainly an efflorescence, a bloom of quilting as an art form, because the palette was extremely extended. Long around the same time, you also had the invention of machines that allowed for fancy designs instead of standard quilting. But let's get back to the hospitals, because the plot thickens. The cloud falls over the brightness of the fabrics at the hospitals, as many hospitals decided to reinstate uniforms. And so the cool scrubs went away. But have no fear, because soon everyone will be wearing face masks made by volunteers everywhere. I want to give a special shout out to the Pajaro Valley Quilters Guild and other quilters groups all over the country, as well as independent volunteers. People are making a difference. In fact, I can tell you that there is a group over at the Fab Lab in our own Santa Cruz community who is working on fabricating masks for the cause. We need to get masks out to everyone who needs them, and that's soon going to be everybody. Everybody is going to be wearing masks on their faces, and we'll find that we flatten the curve further by this behavior, but hey, we got to make it interesting. So I am looking for those quilters to choose interesting designs. I'm hoping for maybe the Rolling Stones mouth on my mask, actually. It's an inspiring story and a little bit fun, and goodness knows we could all use some fun right now. Everybody can do something to help. Everybody, creative or not creative, can do something, even if it's just going to the market for your older neighbor or helping in some other way. This is an all-hands-on-deck situation. Even though we may have to be on separate decks, we definitely need all the hands. So everyone can do something to help. I urge you to go online and search and figure out what it is that you feel called to do. Let's move into more on ACE2, angiotensin converting enzyme 2. It's found in the lungs. It's found in the kidneys, the heart, the blood, and the intestines. It lowers blood pressure. It catalyzes the cleavage of angiotensin II, which is, by the way, made by angiotensin converting enzyme. So let's talk a little. There's a little rule of biology that's relevant here. The rule of biology is that things turn other things on, and one of the things that they turn on always eventually turns out to be the thing that turns them off. It's essentially a kind of clock or timer. Blood clotting cascade works that way. Everything works that way. The second rule of biology is that the rule of yin and yang. If there's a thing that does something, there's going to be another thing that exists that will do the exact opposite. And they'll tend to both fuel and inhibit each other. It is a really interesting loop, and everything is structured this way. This is how these dynamic systems work. So you've got angiotensin-converting enzyme, and you've got angiotensin-converting enzyme 2. And the ACE2 is largely a membrane protein, and that means it's on the surface of the cells. Half of it is outside the cell, and half of it is inside the cell. And it's the entry point of a whole bunch of viruses. Now, you've heard about coronaviruses, but you may not realize that there is a whole list of bugs that use it, including things like anthrax. So how does this work? Well, in the case of SARS-CoV-2, or I'm going to still keep calling it COVID-19, I think it's much catchier, and it works with my little visual image of a crow with the number 19 hanging around his neck, which is, I'm a visual thinker, so I typically see concepts, and that is what that virus looks like to me, not the little ball with the spikes on it. But that spike protein's interesting. It's actually like a little spring-loaded clothespin. We'll come back to that in a second. Once the COVID grabs on to the ACE2 enzyme, it's able to enter the cell. That's basically its route in. But it isn't able to just do that. The spike protein has to be opened up. Like I said, it's a spring-loaded clothespin. And the coronaviruses have been around for a very long time. Then they weren't all that dangerous. They caused about a third of colds. And then about 12 to 15 years ago, we became aware that they had mutated. And what happened is they got stickier. They got stickier and they didn't fall off the ACE2 as easily. Now, at the molecular level, there's a lot of movement, Brownian motion. Let's think of it as nano wind. So these little spike proteins on the coronavirus are bouncing around on the surface of the cell, and they're trying to grab onto this ACE inhibitor, and they keep getting blown off. The stickier they are, the harder they can grip it, the more likely they are to be able to hang on long enough to inject their RNA into the cell and take over the cell's own protein production factories. The other thing about these very sticky ACEs is they can get down deeper into the lung and stick, and occasionally they infect the cells badly enough to set up an inflammatory storm, too much inflammation, that as far as the alveoli and the capillaries down there at the real fringes of the lung are concerned, they act like a chemical burn. The capillaries start to weep, just like you get a burn that blisters. And unfortunately, that fluid fills the air sacs, and the only way that you can help a person in that situation is to force air into the lungs at high pressure, like we talked about last week. That spring-loaded clothespin, that spike protein, I want to talk about that because it isn't actually active until it bounces off the surface of a cell and encounters another membrane-bound protein that's called furin. I'm pulling up my furin thing. It cleaves the proteins of lots of bacteria and viruses, the envelope proteins of AIDS, flu, dengue, Ebola, and anthrax toxin, Pseudomonas exotoxin, and the papillomaviruses all have to be processed by that thing before they can get into host cells. So it's a case of the molecular hostiles weaponizing something that's present and fairly ubiquitous both in the serum and on the surface of cells. We need our furin, and it's important, but if we could maybe modulate it or slow it down a little bit, that might be a way to actually get somewhere. So over the last week, I've been researching natural furin inhibitors, and I've come across a couple of things that, and I want to emphasize, this is in the category of won't hurt, might help, won't kill you, and or mess you up, because we know that because we use it. And there's some evidence that this works on furin. There's good evidence that it works on furin, that these are furin inhibitors in vivo. The question is, will it do enough or do anything to make you less likely to get COVID-19? And no, can't tell you it will. Not established. This is one of those logical extensions, except this one doesn't lead you to take a dangerous drug. This one leads you to take a nutritional substance that's found in skullcap. Skullcap's an herb. It's very commonly used in Chinese medicine. There are other flavonoid furan inhibitors, but the one that is found in the greatest prevalence in skullcap is one called Baicalin, and that's Baicalin. This is available as a supplement. I've checked, and you can buy it, and there hasn't been a run on the market, so it's still available, or I wouldn't tell you about it, because honestly, I think that's just too scary and frustrating to be told about something and then find that you can't get it. Reference my discussion of hydroxychloroquine last week. Now I'm going to move to the first email we got, because it dovetails right nicely with what I'm going to keep talking about for a minute. This from Sherry Ann in Santa Cruz. Your February 16th discussion of ACE2 and COVID-19 was very interesting. A family member recently sent me this link about a disagreement between the British Medical Journal and others. I will not read the link to you. Can you help us sort this out? Would a switch of ACE inhibitors and ARBs to calcium channel blockers for hypertension be advisable for the near term? P.S. I'm going to read the compliment. You have such an amazing ability to make complicated biochemical mechanisms understandable to non-scientists like myself. I'm so grateful for your many years of public service on the radio and online. Here is my response, Sherry. It's probably a bad idea to worry about this. Now, there is evidence that ARB and the ACE inhibitors do cause an increase in the number of ACE2 on cell surfaces. There is some data that reflects that. However, one has to look at another interesting detail, which is that the ACE2 appears to actually be protective in pneumonia. And so a study that was published in 2012 showed that ACE inhibitors themselves reduced and ARBs, which is angiotensin receptor blockers, specifically reduced the risk of pneumonia or the severity of pneumonia in the ICU. Now, these are all pneumonias for all causes, so clearly there's another mechanism here, presumably an anti-inflammatory one, that's making a difference. So categorically, don't stop taking, if you're on valsartan or you're on lisinopril, don't stop taking it. Anecdotally, and this goes back to 2002, a press release came out that said that Primpro caused increased risks of breast cancer, and the country almost spontaneously combusted from all of the heat of all of the women who abruptly went cold turkey off of their estrogen and had lots and lots of hot sweats, sleep deprivation, and temper. Don't stop your meds. If you have a sudden increase in your blood pressure, that could backfire spectacularly. What if it caused a stroke, or what if it strained your heart and put you into heart failure or gave you a heart attack? Also, diabetic patients are often taking these drugs for kidney protection, and that could actually injure their kidney to stop them suddenly. If you got sick, if you got one of these complications from stopping your drugs, you would end up in an urgent care or an emergency room, and that would expose you to the virus, the very thing that you stopped the medicine because you were afraid of it. And just, you know, comment on fear. Often, the unconsidered actions that we take as a result of our fear actually lead to the thing that we fear happening. And this is a classic example of that. Don't go to the hospital right now. Don't do things that might take you to the hospital because there's sick people there. Plus, even if there were some kind of theoretical benefit to your ACE2 surface on your cells, there's going to be some latency for that.
weeks and weeks before it would do anything. So you've got plenty of time. You could just keep taking your medications, let this first wave die down, and let us get released on cognizance. Let's not create any emergencies for ourselves. So categorically, no, Sherry, I don't. I think that the study that came out in The Lancet was purely an observational epidemiologic study, and it said, hey, people with high blood pressure and people with diabetes seem to get sicker. Well, yeah, they get sicker from their heart attacks. They get sicker from influenza. They get sicker from everything because their systems are weakened by their pre-existing conditions. Diabetes and hypertension are associated with increased risk of death from all causes. So epidemiologically, there'll be a connection. That's an important thing to understand. You never, ever, ever make clinical decisions based on epidemiology. Not this kind of clinical decision. And it's really important that we keep our heads here. So I mentioned Baicaline, and that's Baicaline. And I looked up dosing, and dosing ranges for safety have been shown to be up to 2,000 milligrams. Don't take that much. Whatever benefit you're going to get, you're probably going to get at around 250 to 500 twice a day. And that's based on the studies looking at furin inhibition for other causes. Ultimately, folks, that's a very safe amount of this bioflavonoid. It might do you some good. It might not. If you're already on L-arginine for your high blood pressure, pat yourself on the back. That may also have some protection. There are breakdown products of L-arginine which do show benefit for as furin inhibitors. I wouldn't go on L-arginine for that, but it is a good agent if you are on it for blood pressure. So I might as well put out a commercial for that, and I typically use about 4,000 milligrams once daily for the L-arginine effect. Let's go to that first email. This from Michael. He reached me by emailing onair@ksqd.org. Could you talk about the advantages and drawbacks of trying to hurry the search for a vaccine for COVID-19? Also, we hear about the low numbers of confirmed COVID-19 cases in our three Monterey Bay counties. Can we take some comfort in these low numbers? Thanks, Michael. Michael, the numbers that we are seeing reflect the number of people who are sick enough to be tested. And the criteria for sick is that you have to have a really bad viral cough. You have to have either hypoxia or a fever or both preferred, or you have to have a known exposure to a case and be sick, but maybe not that sick. So we've got 54 in Santa Cruz County, 42 in Monterey County, that's of today, two deaths in Monterey County, one death in Santa Cruz County. It's early days yet, folks. What we've done by flattening out the curve is that we are slowing the spike, and the numbers are going up slower than they went up in Italy, in France, and that's locally. In New York, you're seeing the kind of numbers at the rate of increase that we saw in Italy and France. So it's slower here. We probably can credit Dr. Gail Newell, the county public health officer, who put her shelter-in-place order out 3 days before the rest of the state, and another, I think, 4 or 5 days before New York finally put a shelter-in-place order in. They were a bit slower, so we get to see what slow looks like, and we got to see what fast looks like. It's still going to be a big wave across our sides, and it's going to rock the boat majorly, and it's given us time to prepare and get our act together a little bit, and that's really, really important. But we really have no idea how many
active cases are out there. And the recent order that's come down or will come down soon that we all need, that everybody should wear masks for droplet precautions, basically means that we have more evidence now for asymptomatic transmission. In a lot of viral infections, and I don't think it's confirmed for COVID, but it is a thing, you're often, it's contagious before you get sick. But your contagion at that point, before you're sneezing and coughing, is very, very local. So that's where families being very careful. Just if you assume that your family members have the virus and you wash your hands before you eat, and you know get your silverware really clean because you're sharing it, or else don't share your silverware cups and plates. Just everybody gets their assigned color or something like that. And yeah, you might want to consider, in the case of children, they need hugs and you need hugs. But in the case of somebody with a runny nose, maybe you're going to wash your hands carefully after that hug. And everyone's going to have to come to their own conclusions there, but certainly we need to be extremely, extremely careful. This is a email that went to the AskDrDawn.com site, and this from Richard in, I love the name, Wolverine Lake, Michigan. Okay, Wolverine Lake, atypical medicine. I find comfort in your explanations and presentations. I really like that you're a real doctor, MD, but I do put DOs in the same category and completely comfortable seeing a PA. When you speak about what some may consider an alternative treatment, you are fully trained and qualified to treat someone medically. I would like to hear your opinion about the practitioners who are not trained to medically treat people but offer nutritional solutions. I believe the IFM certification is explicitly in the person's field of practice, so this seems totally legitimate. In other words, there are IFM certified physicians, and there are IFM certified physician's assistants, and there are IFM certified nutritionists, and their scope of practice is derived from the professional scope of practice of their training and licensure. That was my addition, by the way. I even believe that most of us could probably benefit from some nutritional supplements. I'd like to hear your opinion about the non-medical providers that seem to really push supplements, and especially about the people who seem to think muscle testing is a science. If you tell me there's research, I'll read it. I suspect that this is a bit like homeopathic dilutions, where the belief that the water remembers what was in it before it was so diluted, that there's no longer molecules of the item remaining in all the dilutions. I've benefited from hypnotism for pain management and enjoyed entertainer hypnotists, and I've even heard of studies supporting the placebo effect as treatment, and I can believe it. I just know that some people otherwise seem reasonable but believe in stuff like that, and I think he's referring there to the muscle testing. In a related but perhaps more real treatment strategy, I'd like your opinion on DCs, that's Doctors of Chiropractic, and how and when to choose one. Thanks for the education and the entertainment. All right, well, I'm going to start with that last question first and say that doctors of chiropractic have a really good understanding of neurology and anatomy. And in particular, I've learned more from chiropractors than I ever learned from my medical training about the spinal interneurons and the way that they affect muscle tension. So you can basically have a situation where pain on one side of your body causes you to hold tension, and eventually you'll develop pain in other parts of your body. And when that tension and initial pain is due to something called a subluxation, manipulation can be very beneficial. There are hidden reflexes, and there's neurological inhibition of these reflexes, and there are echoes that move throughout the body. And they can also really know their nutrition. And there are lots and lots of good ethical chiropractors, and there's a few real entrepreneurs who are out there, and they're usually the ones that look the slickest. So my advice there is, if it's really slick and there's a link to a store right on the front page and it's their brand name on the product, those are all red flags for someone that I wouldn't necessarily trust. Let me give you a personal story, though, about this understanding of neurology that I was mentioning. Because a few years ago, about, 8 years ago now, I can remember it like just yesterday, though, I had a lot of really severe back pain. And I hadn't really strained myself. It was on the left side, right under the ribs. Checked my kidneys, of course, checked everything. The pain was so severe it would wake me up in the middle of the night. I tried antacids, I tried all sorts of things, and it didn't seem to respond. And it was really disabling. I went to my doctor. My doctor couldn't figure it out. I had some additional testing done. Wasn't clear what was going on. I got manipulated by my friend, the chiropractor, a couple of times. It really didn't seem to help. And this guy is really honest, and he basically said, you know, this is not chiropractic. This is not mechanical. I think you need to revisit the possibility that this is referred pain from your stomach, because it turns out, yeah, the area where the pain was centered was a referral point, which means that when the nerves to the organ are irritated, you'll have pain in that area of your back. And it's a real thing. It's related to too much activity on the switchboard for the afferent nerves going into the spinal column. So much activity, in fact, that they activate the nerves, essentially transferring effectively the pain impulse to the other branch of that nerve, which is the one that goes to the back at that level. So long story short, or maybe long story long, with that knowledge, I discovered a very old remedy that took care of my pain whenever I got it. I went on an elimination diet, and I got some allergy testing and figured out that I was eating a food I was highly allergic to that was causing very severe inflammation in my stomach. And once I stopped eating that food, within a couple of weeks, I had fully recovered. And sad to say, I can't eat very much chicken, which is too bad because chicken is a wonderful food. But, you know, aside from that, we're in pretty good shape, and I am profoundly grateful to my friend the chiropractor for helping me figure that out, or really for figuring it out himself. So getting back to, that's it on chiropractors. Now let's talk about muscle testing. First of all, there really is research, and I went through carefully, and before we talk about it, I need to define some terms, because there's really two things. There's muscle testing in the osteopathic sense versus in the toxicity sense. And so we're going to call them applied kinesiology, osteopathic, and we're going to call it, and by the way, that term, it gets used indiscriminately as well. You just have to define your term. So I'm going to call it allergy response or toxin response or nutritional deficiency response. So disease response testing, deficiency or poison response testing, and osteopathic testing. So the osteopathic testing is a little bit along the lines of the chiropractic story I just told you. The idea is that when there's activity in one area, it can go up to the spinal cord and sort of spread over to another area. And in the case of this, you'll find weakness of a muscle that isn't necessarily directly related to the area where the person is having pain. In fact, it may be on the opposite side of the body. And when you treat this through manipulative means or through, I've had it treated through acupuncture quite successfully. The acupuncture isn't on the painful side, it's on the opposite side where it's weak, which isn't even symmetrically the same thing. But that managed to reboot the system, like hitting a reset button, and turn off the spinal interneuron and reduce the pain. So I can personally attest that there is, in my view, something to this. But now let's talk about the other kind of muscle testing, which is the toxin allergy nutritional deficiency testing. And when you look at the cognitive there, the best way to think about it is that this is being used to test allergies. And the idea is that sometimes they'll have you put something under your tongue. Sometimes they'll have you hold it in your hand. And then Usually it's your arm, but you can use the finger, you can use the pincher, finger to index, finger to thumb grasp, and try to break that. Tell the person to hold really tight and then try to break it. And this is supposed to be a way of testing whether, for example, the person is allergic to the substance in the vial, or whether they're deficient and need this thing. So in that case, you put it in their hand and they get stronger. And there's a lot of hypnosis going on here. And there are placebo studies, good ones. I'll be sending these back. I'll send the links back to Richard or us, else PDFs of the abstracts of the articles, which I found. And essentially this idea that the allergy testing is, it's just not supported by the literature. I did find one study, which was not placebo-controlled. It was published in a journal in 1998. It was a single laboratory in Israel, and they tested IgE and IgG for food, and then they had previously done this sort of muscle testing, muscle response testing, to look for allergies, and they showed that of 19 people who tested positive, there was a 90% correlation of the suspected food allergies. Well, that sounds good, but there was no placebo, and this wasn't a very technically good study. On the other hand, I found a really excellent placebo study, and this one was published in March of 2014. The author is Schwartz, and if you put this in Google Scholar, Schwartz, Explore, 2014, March, April, it'll show up with AK or Applied Kinesiology in your search. In this case, very good study, excellent methodology. They tested a bunch of different kinesiologists, 51 participants, three trials each. Let's see, I'm sorry, they had two kinesiologists. Then they had a grip strength indicator, and I've always looked for this study. There's this thing called a dynamometer. Think about those hand exercise spring-loaded things. Well, it's like that, except it measures how hard you push the spring. They also measured how hard the kinesiologist was pushing on the person's arm, and they used a pressure pad system. So the hand dynamometer results, same set of vials. This was identifying a toxin. So they had 151 sets of trials. The toxin was identified correctly in 53%, exactly what you'd get with a coin toss. The kinesiologists were like way not statistically significant. The chance of false positive, 43%. These are just pretty random and no way, it just were not good enough, not even close. I mean, orders of magnitude below okay for showing any kind of statistical significance. And there have been, I found multiple review articles that also looked at the literature and essentially concluded that whenever anybody used a placebo group, this type of muscle testing didn't work. And the kinesiologists, by the way, were using different levels of pressure. Maybe that was subconscious. Maybe if they're telepathic, it was sure not working in that lab on that day. So I think I'm feeling pretty clear that that type of muscle testing is just hokum. So we're moving to our next email. And this one is from Bill in Santa Cruz County. Bill writes, bovine colostrum for asthma, ? What do you think of taking bovine colostrum to reduce asthma? In an article put out by PubMeds from 2016, he quotes the article. It's basically bovine colostrum supplementation and upper respiratory symptoms during exercise training. And it was a review of that topic. And the authors say that they had some studies that were that had statistical significance, but they also state at the end, there appears to be an inherent bias, and the authors call for more testing, says Bill. I did review that article, and basically that's what they say. They say, well, you know, we found some significant results. We don't think there was publication bias because there was a lot of negative results. Well, that's a false presumption. We'll come to that in a second. But the studies that showed positive effects of colostrum had low precision, and this needs to be followed up with more adequately powered studies. Well, I found some adequately powered studies. Let me talk about publication bias for a moment, though. This is a technical term, and it means that positive studies tend to get published more often than negative studies. And I claim that publication bias definitely exists for basic science, and it exists for pharmaceuticals. But I think we have reverse publication bias in the natural world. I see negative studies published with a very great frequency in journals like New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association, usually saying that vitamin D doesn't work to prevent heart attacks. And it's like, okay, well, I never said it did, and it isn't listed, and you know, my alternative training is fairly extensive, and I don't see that claim. So great. You disproved a claim no one makes. Also, when you look at the methodology of these studies, they almost appear to be designed to fail and, I might add, get published. I think the fix is in a lot of the times. And I think there's a publication bias against natural medicine in the sense that negative studies are published about natural medicine at a much higher observable frequency than negative studies about pharmaceuticals. And you can draw the conclusions you like from that. Now, getting back to bovine colostrum, what the heck is that? Well, basically, when a mammal lactates in the initial phases of lactation, there is a compound called colostrum, which is basically almost pure antibodies. It's got lots and lots of IgA and IgG. And in the case of bovine colostrum, it also has immune complexes. That is to say, it has IgG that the cow made, and it has the antigens that the cow ate, and they're connected to each other. This is important because we know that IgG antigen complexes actually reduce inflammatory cytokines in the mammalian gut. So essentially, they act as a calming agent. Also, the IgG that isn't bound can grab pathogens. And there's a lot of literature looking at whether bovine colostrum can help with acute gastrointestinal studies. And I found an excellent article. A great review article on this. This was published in Frontiers of Nutrition, and it was June 22nd, 2018, and the author is Ulfman, U-L-F-M-A-N. That should be enough for anybody who wants to dig it up to find it. It's an excellent article, and it actually is, the entire article is free. There's a wonderful discussion in this article about the bovine immune globulin, how it works, how it's derived, but essentially even in cow's milk, at least raw milk, and they didn't address whether homogenation destroys the IgG, but it wouldn't surprise me if it did, and that may be a factor here, but GI acid does not, and they looked also at humans, human milk, and it also contains a lot of IgG, but in the case of adults, adult humans that you're trying to treat or older children, we typically are using bovine colostrum. There were a number of good studies looking at allergies and asthma, which is what our person is wondering about. Could we use this to reduce asthma? Bill wonders because Flovent and albuterol have negative side effects and are quite expensive. I do want to give you a tip, Bill. You can get your albuterol costs down. That one's at least generic. You go by using a good RX coupon, and you could probably get your cost down to $20-$25 for an inhaler. The steroid inhalers are generally more expensive. These were all old generic drugs. And then the thing with the ozone layer came along, and the FDA, I might add, unique in the industrialized world, let these guys repatent their drugs because they were using a different inert propellant, which is criminal. And that, in fact, is one of the events that convinced me, just without a doubt, that the fix is in Washington, at the FDA, and that we are the food animals and the pharmaceutical industry are the prey animals. Getting back to Bill's question, there is good data that bovine colostrum improves pulmonary function testing, including FEV1. And I found that article in a journal called, a very obscure journal called Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. This is like the big allergy journal, in November 2016, volume 117, issue number 5. And the author is C. Wong, initial C. And in the title is 0033 bovine colostrum. So if you search that, Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and you search that date, and the 033 bovine should turn it up for you. And this is a very short article, but very useful, randomized, double-blind, controlled, placebo-controlled trial, children, 38 children aged 7 to 18, placebo, so we got that check, daily for 3 months, okay, good duration, pulmonary function medicine, which is a highly reproducible measurement that we use all the time, also symptom score, not necessarily so reproducible, and the asthma control test, which is quite highly reproducible. And basically what they saw was good statistical significance. We got p equals 0.006 with improved FEV at 3 months compared to placebo. That, my friends, is way better than your average pharmaceutical. Will it be enough? What was the magnitude of the improvement? Maybe enough for some people that they don't need to use their inhaler. But if you've got asthma, I do recommend, you know, getting the coupon and having an albuterol inhaler around, because you do need to be able to rescue yourself in the event that you get a viral infection that goes to your lungs and flares your asthma. If you're looking for other things to support your system for allergies and asthma, I highly recommend a probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus. And that's R-H-A-M and N-O-S-U-S, and 10 billion, with a B, billion, colony-forming units a day is an extremely effective treatment for allergies and asthma, and there is a truckload of data in support of that. Some of the other lucky people who sent me emails that are going to get answered today, we've got Marion in Monterey. Mastering diabetes. I would love to hear your take on the therapeutic dietary approach of mastering diabetes, guys. Their new Mastering Diabetes book is on the New York Times bestseller list. They say fats greater than 15% in the diet promote insulin resistance. The best interview of them I've heard out of several so far is the Rich Roll podcast, which she gave me, and I will confess, Marion, I didn't have the bandwidth to listen to the podcast, but I did go and look at their website and immediately got itchy. Neep, 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 BS alarm, BS alarm. And that had to do with the sort of closed door secret knowledge thing. You could buy their book, pay them some money, or you could join one of the programs, pay them some money. But otherwise, it was just the door of a peep show at a circus tent. So I thought, all right. I went online, found the book. I could read a sample of the book. So I read the sample of the book that they put up there, and I looked at the table of contents. Something jumped out at me. No bibliography. Well, maybe they didn't bother to label it. Maybe there is a bibliography. Maybe they do cite the research. So off to Google Scholar I went, and that's where I found basically a lot of research that basically didn't say that more than 15% of fat was going to cause insulin resistance. I think this is largely a misinterpretation of the fact that if you're eating a lot of fat, you will have statistically, again, epidemiology, a higher rate of obesity. And if you've got obesity, you're going to have a higher rate of diabetes, just a given. And it's much more complicated than that. It's like, what kind of fat? So I did find a really interesting article on randomized controlled feeding trials. These were human trials looking at blood glucose, insulin, hemoglobin A1C, insulin sensitivity, and insulin secretion in adults greater than 18. Basically, this was looking at all kinds of trials comparing carbohydrate to fat, and basically what they found was that polyunsaturated fatty acids were linked with improved glycemia, improved insulin resistance, and insulin secretion capacity. Oh, I did find the 15% fat insulin resistance. I did find that. It was in a rat study using insulin clamping. And basically, this didn't pan out in human trials. It's as simple as that. And I'm sure these guys have built their empire. In fact, one of them built one empire. And, you know, they're marketing geniuses. They've got Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, you know, minions, making sure that they have a presence on whatever social media site exists. And they're pulling in a lot of dough. And, you know, I think that health advice from the New York Times bestseller list is not a great place to go. And I think these guys are selling their thing, making as much money as they can. And if they want to, if they want my approbation, they're going to have to show me their science, because I couldn't find it in Google Scholar, and I looked. And we've got time for this. Sybil in SoCal writes, I've been putting generous amounts of parsley in my green drink, thinking it's nutritious. Now I'm reading that it's bad for the liver and kidneys. And another link tells me it's good for the kidneys. It all depends on the dose. You can definitely overdose on parsley. It's a condiment. And in higher levels, it contains things that will stress your liver. And it's highly diuretic, so that stresses your kidneys. There you go. That's why it's confusing. Sybil also writes, I've been spraying a brand of colloidal silver, but that also contains oregano oil in my mouth. Whenever I was out, I've read that one should not continuously take colloidal silver. How much is safe, and is it safe to take oregano oil internally? Dr. Vile advises against. Well, it depends on how long you take it. I use oregano oil a lot when I'm treating bad bacteria or a yeast in the intestines. I'll treat for about 6 weeks. That's usually enough. In this case, if you're trying not to get a virus, I don't recommend oregano oil for that purpose. I also like to put colloidal silver in my nose. And I don't particularly like to put it in my mouth. The amounts that you shouldn't take are like 8 ounces at a time. There are people with colloidal silver machine who drink a glass of the stuff every day, and their skin turns a kind of gray color. It's otherwise completely non-toxic. The oregano oil can, if you take enough of it, mess up your microbiome, which is why I only treat for 6 weeks. Now, she has been using vodka as a hand sanitizer, but she learned that it's only 40% alcohol. You need something stronger. You need 60 per, okay, so I'm going to put it this way. You need 91% strength rubbing alcohol. It says so right on the label. And then 2/3 of your hand sanitizer has to be that strength of rubbing alcohol. It got confusing there because people were saying, well, 65% rubbing alcohol, and that wasn't the percentage strength of the rubbing alcohol, that was the amount that was in the hand sanitizer, and it was bad wording, and it led to some people making mistakes. Now, is it neurotoxic? Yeah, if you eat rubbing alcohol, it's neurotoxic. Don't drink it. And if you do use hand sanitizer, try not to lick your fingers. Small amounts of colloidal silver spray that you put in your nose or even in the back of your throat, that's not going to hurt you. Small amounts of oregano oil. Remember, oregano is a spice. You eat it. Don't go above milligram doses of the stuff. So, you know, a teaspoon of oregano oil is way too much. A teaspoon of oregano, not a problem. And that brings us panting and skidding safely to home base. It's time to finish the program. I want to thank you so much for listening and so much to all the emailers. I'll be back next week. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay healthy, and try to keep away from the hospitals unless you're a care provider. There's sick people there.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.